Good morning to you all. I'm blessed to assemble with you, as I am blessed every first day of the week to be with people who care about Jesus and about his words and about his work. I invite you to join me now in Romans chapter 12. Romans chapter 12. I do want to say a couple of things before I get into the sermon. Those of you who are here on a regular basis know that it's been quite a while since I've been up here to preach. And that is due to the generosity and the thoughtfulness of those of you men who stepped up in my absence while my family is growing exponentially. Those of you who stepped up to help me in the burden of teaching and the responsibility that carries. I'm thankful for you all. For your work in serving the congregation as you have. And I also want to thank not just those of you men who came and preached, but all of you who prayed for us. It was a birth experience that we were not sure how it was going to go coming into it, but it went so smoothly, and I have no doubt that that was due to the prayers of the saints. Not just ours, but all of you who went to God on our behalf. Thank you so much for doing that. Thank you for all of the food that you have showered upon us. We have fridges and freezers full of food because of you. We have extra money in our bank account because of you. We have clothes for our children because of you. Thank you for everything that you have done for us. You know, Jesus, when you think about Jesus, he loved little children. And he always had time for them, and he still does. And there's just something really beautiful about Jesus' people imitating his example in loving little children and the parents who are trying to raise them. So we are appreciative of all of you, and I know I speak for Jenny when I say that we feel loved by this congregation. We really do. Okay, having said all that, let's try to get into Romans 12 now. As you know, we are working through this chapter, concentrating on this theme of being a living sacrifice that comes from the first couple of verses of this chapter. And so, as is our custom, I'd like to read those verses with you before we talk about anything further. Romans chapter 12, verse 1, I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. When I look at those first two verses out of Romans 12, there are two C words that come to mind: comprehensive and continual. Comprehensive in that this living sacrifice that he is calling us to become for the will of God, because you notice what this is all leading to. It's not a goal in and of itself to be a living sacrifice. It has the result then at the end of verse 2 of becoming someone who knows how and is motivated to do the will of God. Everything that he is and wants us to become. So this sacrifice that we are to become is comprehensive. Jesus wants not just a piece of you, he wants all of you. He doesn't just want a sliver of your personality or your finances or your relationships or a Sunday morning of your schedule. He wants everything that has to do with you. That is a sacrifice to give that much of ourselves, is it not? That's why it's called that. But it's not just comprehensive. This sacrifice is also continual. You know, when you look at the Old Testament sacrifices, they were terminal activities, weren't they? I mean, you can only kill an animal one time, and then it's dead. You can't keep killing it. I mean, now, you can offer additional sacrifices, and you can keep killing animals, and that is, of course, what they did constantly under the Old Testament law. But the sacrifice didn't keep on going. You did it, you brought it to the temple or the tabernacle, the priest killed the animal, shed its blood, and then you're done, you go home. But for us, as followers of Jesus, who did offer a one-time sacrifice that cleanses all of us for all time. What we are called to be is to devote not just one day, not just one action, not just this really big sacrifice back here that I did for this person, but to devote our entire existence to the Lord. That is a sacrifice, to give that much of ourselves, is it not? That's why it's called that. So that is what we're talking about this year, is what does that mean, to give that much of ourselves to the Lord? And so last month we focused on the very first part of verse 9, because most of the monthly sermons are coming out of verses 9 through 21. Notice the very first part, again, of verse 9 is, let your love be genuine. And if you know the writings of Paul, you know how much this guy, who is sometimes called a cranky personality, how much he talked about love. Obviously, to the Corinthians, he's got a lot to say about love there. It is the first. It is what exceeds or what outlasts faith and hope. It must be in the life of a Christian. And it is here at the front of this list of very practical things a Christian must do. Let your love be genuine or unhypocritical, depending on your translation. But then, what's right after it is what I want to focus on today. Before we take the supper together. Abhor what is evil, hold fast to what is good. This is a command to properly align our affections, what we care about, and what we don't care about. Because this is how Jesus aligned his affections leading up to the cross. This is why he went to that hill and died for your sins and my sins. We're going to end this lesson in Hebrews chapter 1 to see that. Very clearly, if we call ourselves after his name, we've got to imitate what he abhorred and what he clung to. Your translation, instead of hold fast in the ESV that I'm using, you might have cling to what is good. The same idea. What I want to do is kind of break down these four words. Abhor evil, hold fast to good. Because I think it's easy to take these words and sort of brush past them as if we already understand what they are talking about. I want to go a little bit more slowly through this text and this phrase so that we can really wrap our minds around this. When I looked up the Greek word for abhor, it just means to have a vehement dislike for something, to hate strongly. You know, I'm guessing that there is a type of food that you really do not like to have sitting on your plate whenever you sit down to a meal. I know for Steve, because he mowed lawns in Florida and ran over a bunch of avocados, he can't stand avocados today. I know Holly can't stand eggs. I'm sure if I went around the room and I asked each one of you, what makes you gag? I think most of us would have something. It's raisins for me. And I know I sound like a spoiled American, but and I know if I was on a desert island and I only had raisins, I would eat them gratefully. But if I had choice, raisins would be the last choice, the last one on the list. They are gross. Those of you who like them, I do not understand you. I love you as a brother or sister, but it's in spite of your food choices. I'm also guessing that there are creatures that you can't stand to be around. Maybe it's a type of bug. In my family, my little girls abhor spiders. And they will forcefully call me into whatever room they're in if they happen to run across one of them. Daddy, your daddy's so big! And it's actually pretty small. But it's terrifying to them. What is it for you that works that way? And what is your reaction when you come across something that you truly detest? Again, if it's food, you don't want it on your plate. Maybe not even on the table. If you're polite, you will allow it on the table. But if you come across something that is a spider that you detest, if it's a tarantula walking across your pillow, you happen across that, you're not going to shrug your shoulders and say, Well, I know. I mean, that just happens. Oh, well.
No, you're going to be reaching for your shoes. You're going to be madly trying to kill that little booger. You're at least going to yell and scream until that is dead or it's removed from your presence. Now, the challenging question, all that's humorous, but the challenging question about all that is that your reaction to evil? Is it? Wherever and whenever you come across evil, not just in other people, but in yourself. I want you to think about that. Because that is what he's talking about here. Now, that kind of begs the question of what is evil? Evil is one of those words that we throw around a lot in our vocabulary, often in conversations about brutal world dictators from history. So Stalin, Hitler, people like that, they are evil. But the word has a very broad meaning. And you can tell that by looking at the definition of the word, the Greek word that's used there in the text for it. I mean, morally or socially worthless, wicked, bad, base, vicious, degenerate. So that kind of helps us get a closer sense of what this is talking about. But I looked at this definition, and I thought, you know, we need something else than that. So what I want to do is I want to tie this word to a text in the Gospels where Jesus actually uses the same Greek word to talk about what evil is. So I want to read this passage from Mark chapter 7, 20-23, where Jesus is explaining the corruption of the heart and what can come out of it. For from within, out of the heart of man, come evil, same word, thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, coveting, wickedness, deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, foolishness. All these, and here he just names them, evil things. All these evil things come from within and they defile a person. So, like all moral lists in the Bible, this one is not comprehensive at all, but Jesus is specific enough in giving us some very concrete things to think about that we can get a better sense of what evil means. It's not just this concept in the clouds. It translates into specific actions and thoughts that you can do, that you can think. I want you to notice a couple of things about this list. First of all, did you notice, as we read through all this, that every single one of these things, if it is in your heart, your mind, and in your deeds, brings harm and not blessing to another person around you? Now, again, some of these are just mental attitudes. So if you look at the list, you'll notice that coveting or envy is on this list. But we all know, and he is teaching in this passage, whatever is in your mind is going to come out of your heart and translate into what you do. All of this hurts other people. Something else about this list that you'll notice is that some of these things are more obviously evil than other ones. Do you notice that? I think when we look at murder on this list, we all say, oh yeah, I mean, obviously that's evil. But if I had read through this list and I hadn't told you that Jesus called all of these things evil, would you call them all evil? I'd say I probably wouldn't. Like, look at this word here. Foolishness. Do you think being foolish is evil? Well, you know, it's not wise. It's not good. But is it really evil? Let me think about this in a really concrete example. Proverbs says, "The way of a fool is right in his own eyes, but a wise man listens to advice." Did you know that? In this specific example, if you reject the godly advice of other people around you, that is evil. Not just unwise, it's not just, well, it's really not the best thing to do. It's wrong, it's sinful, and Jesus calls that evil. All these evil things corrupt us and corrupts the other people around us. We let them. This is very broad in scope. So, abhor that, Jesus says through the Apostle Paul, and instead hold fast to something else. So this idea of holding fast in the Greek has the idea of joining closely together, binding closely, uniting. It actually has the idea of gluing one thing to another. I'm not sure what they had in the ancient world for glue. Evidently they had something. And they had a word that they used to try to describe that process of taking two things and combining them together so they become one. And you might recognize this phrase from the letter to the Ephesians, because when Paul's teaching about marriage, he is talking about, and Jesus will do this too in Matthew 19, he describes a man holding fast to his wife and the two becoming one flesh. Marriage is interesting because if you look at a marriage, you have two individual people. You have a man and you have a woman, but they form a very close unit. And we could talk about that obviously in the sexual relationship, but much more than that, what this means is the man and the woman's spiritual goals and priorities and daily work and their entire lives are now not, well, you're doing your thing and I'm doing mine and we sit down at the dinner table once in a while. Well, we now walk in lockstep toward a specific goal and direction that we're both striving towards. That's what marriage is all about. And that is the idea that Paul's bringing into this text here in Romans 12 to say, you hold fast. You glue yourself together to what is good. So in other words, goodness shouldn't just be this thing that we're sort of vaguely attracted to. This really kind of nice spiritual characteristic, float in the clouds kind of idea. This ought to be something that we join ourselves to such an extent that when people hear our name, when people see us doing work in the kingdom of God, they automatically think of the characteristics of the Father that we serve. Isn't that what Jesus taught in the Sermon on the Mount? I mean, at the very beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, right after the Beatitudes, what's he talking about? Light! You are light and you are salt in the earth. And so when people see you, your good works, what should they be automatically doing? Glorifying your Father who is in heaven. That's what he's talking about here. So this idea of goodness is the idea of profitable, generous, upright, virtuous. The opposite of worthlessness and all the things about evil that he talked about there. Did you know that the Greek word good is used 100 times in the New Testament? And that 18 of those times are in the book of Romans? It's almost 20%, y'all. That's a lot. And in chapter 12 of Romans itself, there are three different times where he uses the word good. So obviously, verse 9, the verse that we're talking about this morning in the sermon, he's going to use the word good. But if you back up to verse 2, where he said, don't be conformed to the world, be transformed, renew your mind. Why? So that you can discern the will of God. What is good? What is good? Same word, and acceptable and perfect. And then when you go to the very end of the chapter, notice what he does. At the end, after he's gone through all these practical things, he says in verse 21, do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. You know what that tells me? When you see bookend words like this, that means that everything in the middle, in other words, Romans chapter 12, is an exposition of what goodness practically looks like and what it doesn't look like in some cases. So whenever you see this word, think about the context and what's around it, and that's going to give you a clearer sense of what it means, what you should do. I think that's neat. But the question is, how are you doing with this command in verse 9, holding fast to goodness and abhorring what is evil. How are you doing with that? I want to pivot a little bit now. And again, this is out of a desire to try to put this out of the clouds and put this on the ground level for us to think about. I want to look at what this meant in somebody's life in the Old Testament and what it can mean in your life and my life. I want to talk about the temptation of selective abhorrence. In other words, picking and choosing which evil things I hate and which evil things I kind of overlook and gloss over. And, yeah, that's okay, but these things over here are really bad. There are some really good people in the Bible who struggled with this. And if people like David struggled with this, then this is something that Satan can use to great effect with you and me in our lives as well. I want to give a couple of examples about this. I want you to think, you don't necessarily have to turn to 1 Samuel, but I want you to think about this story with me and how David held fast to God's authority with Saul. He left Saul alone, but he abhorred the insolence of Nabal. Think about these two chapters, what happens here. So in 1 Samuel 24, as is often the case in 1 Samuel, David's on the run for his life. Saul's trying to kill him. Saul's trying to kill him a lot. And so David and his men, they're hiding in a cave. And Saul goes into the cave to relieve himself, unknowingly putting himself in an extremely vulnerable position and facing possible assassination, because David and his guys are right there. And so David's guys look at him and they say, "This is your golden opportunity. This is what the Lord said, that he's going to deliver your enemies into your hand. He's right there. Go into the bathroom. Stick a spear into his back." And remember what David does is he says, "Absolutely not." I mean, that guy, as mean as he is to me, he's the Lord's anointed. He's outside of my jurisdiction. I don't have the authority to kill him, so I'm not. But remember what David did. He got his knife and he cut off a little sliver of Saul's robe. But he's so convicted about that that the Bible says his conscience struck him because he did that. He didn't touch Saul, but he got really guilty about the robe and then talked to Saul about that. So that's 1 Samuel 24. He abhorred evil and he clung to what is good in that chapter, but what happens in the next chapter? David sends messengers to this rich guy named Nabal, and he'd been taking care of Nabal's sheep, and he expected to receive something from Nabal, but the messengers come back with a message that Nabal says, I don't care at all about you. There are a lot of servants who are breaking away from their masters these days. Whatever, I'm not going to give you anything. And you remember what David's reaction to that is? Well, let's go kill him then. And were it not for Nabal's beautiful and wise wife, David would have followed through with that. Because she met him on the road, she gave him the supplies that he craved, and he stopped. And he said, "You know what? God used you to turn me from my foolish ways." Isn't it interesting that depending on the person and the situation, David's reaction, David's affections toward evil, the evil in other people's lives, was different. He did the right thing in that chapter, but in the next, with a different person, he went temporarily haywire because he hadn't properly calibrated his abhorrence to evil and his clinging to goodness. Now, fortunately, he got stopped in that, but unfortunately, he didn't get stopped in the next example. And this is one that I'm sure that you're very familiar with. In 2 Samuel 11 and 12, after Saul's been dead for a long time and David has now solidified his rule as king, he's sitting in his palace in Jerusalem. He sent his general Joab and the army out to fight the battles that he used to go out and fight himself. You remember what he does? He holds fast to murder and adultery, but he abhors the hypothetical theft of a poor man's lamb. You remember that? I think the kids downstairs just recently studied about David and Bathsheba. It's a shocking story because it features a man after God's own heart who then acts like one of these wicked pagan kings around the Israelites who just sees something or someone that he wants and takes it regardless of the consequences. So what David does is he dehumanizes Bathsheba by making her an object of lust. He ignores the report that his servants bring back that she belongs to another man. He takes her, he impregnates her, he then kills her husband when her husband unknowingly will not play along with covering up his sin. That's shocking behavior. And it's all the more shocking that he sits on all these sins for at least 9 months. Because when Nathan shows up at the palace, the baby's already in the cradle. And he comes in and he says, I'm going to tell you a story, David. A story about a rich man and a poor man, and you know how it goes. The rich man has so many animals, but he won't take one of them to feed the visitor to his house. He takes the poor man's one ewe lamb. And David doesn't even seem to realize that that's a parable. Because you remember David's reaction to that? David gets angry. And David says this in the text, as the Lord lives, the man who has done this deserves to die, and he shall restore the lamb fourfold because he did this thing and because he had no pity. What do we see here? We see a David who is zealous to enact justice amongst his citizens, but a David who is not that eager to do justice in his own home. You see that? And likewise, I see a lot of people in our culture today, and sometimes even brethren, cry out and spend all of their time talking about the government, talking about our culture, talking about what's wrong out there in the world. We got to get heated about that. And no doubt, there are sins at every levels of our society, and I'm not going to debate that. And we are supposed to pray for our leaders, and I'm not going to deny that. But some of these people who are so concerned about sin out there, you look at their marriages, you look at their children, you look at their homes, you look at the relationships they have with the brethren at their church, and they're not what they're supposed to be. Start with you. Start at home. Do justice amongst the people who are already in your life. Because if Satan can lure David into this trap, any one of us are susceptible to this sin. Last year, I had several studies with a man who has currently decided not to become a Christian. I hope that he will change that. But during the course of our studies, I think we were in Romans chapter 1, he stopped me in the middle of talking about Romans 1. He said, can you believe that there are men who sleep with men? There are women who sleep with women. Can you imagine that there is a month in our calendar in our country that is devoted to these abhorrent practices? And I agreed with him that's pretty bad. Because the Bible says it is. But when it came to other sins in this guy's life, angry outbursts, having a sexual relationship with a woman outside of marriage, he was okay with that. And he did those things. And I'm not bringing him up to beat him up in particular. I'm bringing him up as an illustration that all of us are tempted in this way to selectively hate certain sins. Certain sins that especially other people do that are like nails on the chalkboard. We look at the scriptures, we look at their lives, and we say, how can they possibly be so destructive to themselves and to other people around them? Sometimes when it comes to our own, it's not that big of a deal. Yes, I was unwise there, but it certainly wasn't as bad as what I see that person doing. Do you relate to this line of thought? you hear that people are tearing you down behind your back. Just to name another example. I think it'd be easy to hate that evil. But what about when you're the one tearing other people down behind their backs? Sometimes we're inconsistent even with the same sin. The same sin rubs us the wrong way when it's other people, but when we do it, sometimes it's okay. Do you abhor what is evil and cling to what is good? Do you? I am challenged when I think about myself and put myself in the shoes of Romans 12, verse 9. And I hope that you are too. We are about to partake of the Lord's Supper. So what I want to do now as we close, as we bring all these threads together, I want to focus on the Son of David now. Because you know what the Son of David did? Is he properly showed us what it means to hate what is wrong and to hold fast to what is good. And that is really what led him to the cross. So I want you to leave Romans 12 and I want you to go to Hebrews chapter 1 with me. I want to show you something here at the beginning of the Hebrew letter, if you have your Bibles and you have them open. Hebrews chapter 1. So right after the Hebrew writer opens with long ago, God spoke in a lot of different ways by a lot of different people. But verse 2, he's now spoken in these last days by his Son, whom he appointed the heir of all things, through whom he created the world. Look at verse 3 now, talking about Jesus. He is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature, and he upholds the universe by the word of his power. After making purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high. And then the rest of the chapter goes on to talk about how then he is so much more superior than the messengers, the angels that God uses in the heavenly places to do his will. Jesus sits on the throne. He's above all of them and all of us, obviously. So verse 3, he purified all of us and then he sat down on the throne and became the ruling monarch over the universe. But my question is, as I read verse 3, is what motivated him to do all that for us, especially? Why did he purify us? Why did he go to the cross and suffer the most humiliating, painful death that you could have possibly have suffered in that time in the first century? Well, you keep reading Hebrews 1, and you get more of an answer to that. Look at verse 8 and 9. Now, by the way, the Hebrew writer is quoting a lot of Old Testament passages here in this chapter, as he will often do because he's writing to Hebrew Christians. And so verse 8 and 9 is a quotation from Psalm 45, which is a beautiful psalm, which is a love song devoted to the King of Israel. And on your own time, I encourage you to go back and read that psalm. But from that psalm, he quotes this, "Of the Son, of Jesus, he says, your throne, O God, is forever and ever. The scepter of uprightness is the scepter of your kingdom." Here it is, verse 9. "You have loved righteousness and hated wickedness. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you with the oil of gladness beyond your companions." Did you see that in verse 9? Because Jesus had his affections properly aligned. That is why he was anointed at the end of the verse. That's why he became king. That's why God bestowed on him the blessings that he did. And that is why he will bestow on us the blessings that are coming to us if we are truly disciples of Jesus. If we follow Jesus and do this too. If we want to be servants of the King, if we want to suffer like he did, to be useful as he was, then we need to unselfishly train ourselves, or rather allow ourselves to be trained by God, who gives us these words, so that we can love righteousness and hate wickedness, or in other words, abhor what is evil and hold fast to what is good. So now, as we take the supper together, as we remember the body and the blood that was shed for all of us, let's think about the evil that Jesus hated and the goodness that he loved that led him to the cross. And let's let that prepare us this week to lead us to our crosses, so we can pick them up and follow him wherever he goes.